Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.3 Schenectady. Broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, I'm Kaylin McPherson.
And I'm Erica Diggs. Today, BioHighTech is renewing its push to build a solid waste facility in the city of Rensselaer. After having key permits denied by the DEC, they're back with an even bigger proposal. HMM's Mark Dunley speaks with Dave Ellis of the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition.
Then we have an interview with Alyssa Bolt of the Utica Abolitionist about activism, elections, prison, and police abolition.
And later on, over the Thanksgiving holiday, millions of U.S. residents face food insecurity. Hunger is a 365-day-a-year problem, which has been greatly worsened by the coronavirus pandemic. HMM's Michelle Masurgeon speaks with Barbie Asquirgo, the Community Empowerment Manager with Hunger Free America.
After that, we hear a discussion of Black Reconstruction America from 1860 to 1880 by author W.E.B. Du Bois.
Finally, I have an interview with organizer and Black Lives Matter activist Lukey Forbes about a community call event that happened on Monday. But first, here are some of today's headlines.
Governor Cuomo reported Sunday that the highest statewide infection rate seen since May at 4.27% of 150,000 tests conducted. There are also 55 deaths statewide and 3,372 hospitalizations from COVID-19. 67 Albany County residents were hospitalized Sunday, outpacing a previous record of 45. Cuomo warned that the county and the country and the world are heading into a new winter phase of rising COVID-19 cases that will last until at least the new year.
The governor downplayed the significance of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that shot down the governor's executive order limiting the size of religious services in New York's orange and red zones, where the state has identified surges in the rate of coronavirus infections. Cuomo argued that the decision was largely moot since the plaintiffs were in zones that have since been downgraded. Religious leaders, however, praised the court for its ruling, while critics argued that the court proved the dangers of scientifically illiterate judges overturning government decisions that were based on scientific evidence.
With revenue losses of more than $20 billion due to COVID, New York hospitals are asking Congress for more help on top of the $9 billion directed in federal payments they already received. The American Hospital Association predicts that the collective U.S. hospital will expense the total losses of at least $320 billion this year, not including the impact of surging coronavirus cases this fall.
The Times Union reports that the governor vetoed a bill that would have required permits to alter some 40,000 miles of mostly some unregulated Class C streams across the state, arguing that it would be too costly. Environmentalists say the measure would have protected streams and creeks that often feed into larger bodies of water, as well as drinking water sources.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you live from the Sanctuary Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
BioHighTech is seeking to build a garage facility in Rensselaer. Its initial permit has rescinded both by the city and the state. It is now back with even bigger proposals. We talk with Dave Ellis of Rensselaer Environmental Coalition by Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Dave Ellis, who is with the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition. And they've been very concerned about the proposed BioHighTech garbage proposal for the city of Rensselaer. There have been some good news recently in that both the city had, I guess, rescinded its previous permission, and the state was requiring them to start all over again. But Apparently, BioHitech has come back with an even worse proposal. So, Dave, can you bring our listeners, you know, up to speed? What's going on with this proposal?
Yeah, so BioHitech is doubling down. They're trying to make their point adamant that they want to make Rensselaer home. And they're expanding their footprint. Now they're saying on the site they would also like to add a solar farm and pretty much make their footprint even larger here in the city of Rensselaer, just a stone's throw from the Hudson River on a contaminated brownfield site.
Can you briefly explain what this project is actually designed to do? I understand it brings in garbage and then tries to pull out maybe plastic and paper and that sends that off to get burned someplace. But can you run us through the, you know, a general scope of the project and what some of your concerns might be?
Right. So BioHitech wants to bring in 150,000 tons of solid waste into the city of Rensselaer. This is a new technology that has never been tried before, only once in the entire country. They would dig two massive pits in the ground inside of a climate-controlled building with negative air pressure. So basically, the air stays inside of the building and the stench is not able to leave the property. The garbage trucks from around the entire capital region would come and dump solid municipal waste inside of these huge pits inside the building. The paper and plastic would be separated, shredded, dried out, and then turned into a burnable fuel called a solid recovered fuel, which would then be trucked in massive trucks to cement kilns to be burned as a substitute to coal. Now, this technology has been peddled by BioHitech in the past, but they told us previously that this was just a composting operation, which was a complete lie. Our concerns are that this facility would add to the burden on the city of Rensselaer. We're already impacted by the ever-growing Dunn landfill. This facility is just a stone's throw from the Hudson River, located on a contaminated brownfield site that was the previous home of BASF, a chemical company that had years of toxic chemicals leaking into the ground surface, which is a detriment to the environment. So we're concerned about these chemicals being able to get into the river when the property is disturbed and these pits are dug and the cap for the brownfield cap is pierced. So there's many concerns involved with this project.
Cement, you mentioned that, you know, they want to ship this, you know, created fuel to cement kiln to be burned. You know, cement actually is probably the single largest industrial source of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. I think last I heard it was about 8%. And it just seems like more and more of these cement kilns are looking to burn really nasty stuff. You had the situation over in Ravenna where they're trying to burn tires, and they basically Norlite, which is a not quite a cement kiln, but is an aggregate kiln, same sort of principle, is, you know, the largest, only commercial hazardous waste incinerator in New York. And isn't my recollection that if you end up burning, you know, paper and plastic together, that one of the problems is that it creates dioxins as one of the byproducts of the burning process?
I'm not sure. I believe you're correct, but I'm not positive on that statement.
Okay. So, you know, how are other local governments feeling about this? I know many of the other local governments in the Capital District, you know, their landfill has sort of run out of space. Are they sort of supporting this project as a way to dump their own garbage over into the city of Rensselaer?
Well, we know that the Albany and Colony landfills are almost living their life expectancy. They've had problems with the Colony landfill expanding so close to the Mohawk River. And a lot of the waste stream at the point of time when there was problems with the Colony landfill expanding was actually diverted to the city of Rensselaer and the Dunn construction and demolition dump here in the city. So, you know, there is a huge problem with getting rid of waste in the capital region. So if this facility did come to Rensselaer, I'm sure a lot of municipalities would be sending their waste stream here. I'm not sure if they're in support of the project or not, but we did ask Dennis Soriano, the director of development for BioHiTech, where they planned on sending the waste, solid recovered fuel waste to be burned. He would not give us specific locations. We asked him if he would commit that it would not be sent to the kiln over there in Ravenna, and he wouldn't agree to that statement. So we're very concerned that they're going to try to accept the solid recovered fuel to burn over there, and that's a big problem for our region because those pollutants can go all over the place once they're burned.
Now, it turned out that this particular proposal had been, actually initially, I guess, sort of planned for Orange County, but apparently the company decided to abandon Orange County and come up to Rensselaer. Have they given any explanation as to, you know, why they moved the proposal?
Yeah, so I asked Dennis Soriano on a recent Zoom meeting what their reasoning was for leaving Orange County. And he pretty much told me that the land there wasn't suitable. It would been too far for trucks to bring waste, and there was just a lot of undesirable areas there on the site for development. What we believe was the case is that Orange County heard that this wasn't going to be a great project environmentally, and they, you know, basically told BioHiTech to get packing, but that's not what Dennis Soriano claims.
So what's the, you know, sort of next step in this project? It does seem like the city of Rensselaer is not as gung-ho as it once was, and the state has finally begun to take the project seriously, denied initial permits for it. How does this project move forward, and how does the public have input?
Well, right now, the mayor, Michael Stammel, here in the city of Rensselaer, said that he would require the BioHiTech to basically start over from ground zero. Their permit applications with the city, their planning approvals have expired, and they're now going to have to start over again and submit an entire new plan. And hopefully during that process, the city planning board will require a full environmental review to be placed underway from BioHiTech, which is what the DEC is saying, that it's now up to the city of Rensselaer to basically make the applicant start over again. And once the city either gives their approval or denial, then the DEC will move forward with the process and require the applicant to take further steps with them to make sure they're following all, you know, state and legal guidelines. And then after that, they, you know, if they got the approval from DEC, they could move forward with their state and air quality review permits.
So we only have about a minute left. I'm talking with Dave Ellis, Rensselaer Environmental Coalition. So sort of two-part question. One, I kind of remember that the mayor of the city is also the chair of the county legislature, and I thought he was proposing some type of legislation at the county level to stop all these garbage along the Hudson River. So what's the status of that? And if people want to find out more about this project or Rensselaer Environmental Coalition, how best do they do that in 50 seconds?
Well, the solid waste moratorium in the county was put up for a revote to extend it. It was approved and signed by the county executive, Steve McLaughlin. So hopefully that has some legal weight with these types of facilities along the Hudson River, you know, in a mile along the Hudson River. And to get involved with the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dunn Landfill. And we also have a brand new website coming soon, RensselaerEnvironmentalCoalition.org.
Well, thank you very much, Dave Ellis, Rensselaer Environmental Coalition. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And that was Mark Dunley, who spoke with Davis Ellis, the Rensselaer Environmental, from the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Brendan Dunn interviewed Alyssa Bolt, who is a member of the activist group The Utica Abolitionist. She was brutalized and arrested by police in an anti-police brutality protest in Rome, New York, on October 2nd. Bolt was arrested alongside Juan Gonzalez, as well as reporter Brendan Dunn. The activists are called the Rome Three. This is the second part of a two-part interview.
God.
What brought you into activism? And you also mentioned your intent to run for office. So if you could talk about that.
Yes. So I think it's been a long journey to get to this point where I've felt like I needed to do something for a long time. People ask me sometimes what happened to you to radicalize you? And I think what happened to me was at first in college when I was backpacking in Europe, I was pulled off of a bus and held at gunpoint in German Shepherd Point by a really angry border guard on the Bulgaria-Greek border. He threatened to shoot me if I protested that I had the right to re-enter the Schengen area. And so that really awakened something in me that I can't stand the power that these really low-level authority figures who are not people involved in making policies, but just in enforcement of laws that they don't even understand and that don't make sense, can have so much power of life and death over people. Like, I really could have been killed by this man just to protect the integrity of some fake line on a map. And shortly after this, the Occupy Wall Street movement broke out in New York City, and I wanted so badly to go to that, but I was stuck being a busy graduate student, unable to take off time to go protest, and so I didn't do that. It's been one of my biggest regrets of my life that I wasn't involved in that. I've been looking for my chance ever since to get involved. More recently, I lived in China for a few years where demonstrations don't happen. The last one was 30 years ago. It was brutally suppressed. People really don't have any opportunity to hold their officials and their police accountable. So when I came back to this country, I decided it was going to be really important to me to take advantage of the freedom of speech and the freedom to protest that we have in this country, because I don't want to take that for granted, given that there's a lot of people in this world who don't have that freedom. On a more personal level, I'm doing this on behalf of my fiance and brother who both died in their 20s, both of whose deaths really illustrate things that are wrong with this world. The more recent of those two, my brother passed away from cancer 2 years ago, and for much of his cancer treatment, we were so worried about his health insurance being taken away that it just seemed like the Republican Party was determined to murder him using a policy of taking away people's insurance. And that made, although I cared about this before, that made the whole issue of how messed up America's health insurance model is really personal to me. And that's something that I really want to fight for, that every American has the right to health care and treatment for their illnesses, and that nobody should be without because of some company trying to make a profit. 7 years ago, I lost my fiance, who was a person of color. She was Latina and Native American, under extremely suspicious, strange circumstances that were never fully explained. And I believe that her ethnic background played a role in the police and the coroner not really taking her death seriously and essentially deciding her life didn't matter. So when the movement Black Lives Matter began to take form in the years shortly following this, I have always wanted to be part of this, affirming that, yes, the lives of our country's ethnic minorities do matter, that it's a monstrous thing that our judicial and justice and police systems have just decided that so many people's lives don't matter. We need to stand up and say that, yes, these lives do matter. And so that led me to look for my opportunity to join a Black Lives Matter protest once I felt like I was really ready to do so. Once I got to the point in my transition where at least I was able to be myself and not be someone else, although even now, even after a year on hormones and a legal name change and all that, one of the local newspapers still misgendered me in the article about this arrest, and that was pretty frustrating. But at least I know that I am in all the legal paperwork and systems as myself, not as someone else. So that was really the moment of critical mass for me to feel like I was now ready to get involved and put my neck out there as an activist on the streets calling for change in this country.
You know, it sounds like there's a definite undercurrent, something that links and intersects, you know, all of these different areas and identities and struggles with Black Lives Matter, with queer and trans justice and liberation, with indigenous struggles and movements against the police and police abolition, police brutality, more on in healthcare too, of course. So I don't know if you have something else to comment on that.
I would say that all of these things that have gone on in my life have just pushed me to the point where I can't sit still and not do anything anymore. That I've felt bad for several years about how little I was doing, just trying to maintain a respectable life and build a career and thinking that I could make more change happen that way. I've decided now that whatever else I was trying to do with my life before, this is what's important. Activism and pushing for significant change. I think there's just so much reform that needs to be done in this country. I decided that the next step I was going to take is running for office, and a significant office too. I believe that the volatile 22nd district of New York for Congress is a competitive race that a progressive, idealistic candidate could compete in. And that's exactly what I intend to do. I really want to take all of these issues to the national stage and become one more voice in our nation's government, demanding that people's rights to life and dignity be respected.
Of course, we're in perhaps the final days of the absentee ballot counts that, you know, there's just several thousand remaining. The current Congressman Anthony Brindisi, who's a Democrat in the 22nd Congressional District, one of, I would say, the 15 most conservative Democrats that's in Congress, but also his rival, former Congresswoman Claudia Tenney, who in the past has gone on to brag that, you know, she was Trump before Donald Trump was Donald Trump. So I don't know if you have anything to comment on either Tenney or Brindisi.
I want to say that I'm a better representative of our communities than either of these candidates. Claudia Tenney is a wealthy person of privilege who does not care about the people she supposedly represents. And Anthony Brindisi is a perfectly good person who unfortunately does not represent the struggles of the common people. He's too wealthy, too privileged, too used to having comfort and security to really understand and relate to the struggles of the working class. We've got a lot of people in this district who live paycheck to paycheck. We've got a lot of homeless people in Utica. I would know because I work with Utica's Housing Authority to find solutions for homeless people. We need someone from the lowest income bracket of our society to represent our community, because that's where the people really are. We need someone who's been in the struggle, who's been nearly homeless, who's been discriminated against, who's been on food stamps, who's been poor, broke, discouraged, who's been so desperate that they moved to the other side of the world just for a better financial opportunity, but also so dedicated to making this country right that I came back. And I think that makes me, although I don't have prior elected experience, obviously, I believe that I am a viable candidate because I can speak to the experiences of so many more people than a rich lawyer like Anthony Brindisi or a rich business person like Claudia Tenney.
Finally, I want to ask you a question about the Utica abolitionists and this idea, this vision of abolition and what it means to you. I mean, the whole movement to demilitarize, disarm, defund, and eventually dismantle law enforcement and even prisons as we know it in this country. It's certainly a strong current within the broader Black Lives Matter movement. But what attracted you to that, and what does abolition mean to you?
Well, abolition, in a modern context, I believe, is just a continuation of the 19th century abolition movement. I've read enough on this to believe that modern mass incarceration is really just a continuation of the institution of slavery, using the loopholes provided by the Constitution as it currently stands. I want to be part of this movement that people centuries from now will look back and see as all one continuous thing, that I believe future students of history will see a common historical thread going from the 19th century Northern campaign to abolish slavery through the 20th century civil rights movement, through the 21st century struggle to abolish prisons. And I would also say that abolishing mass incarceration and prisons as we know it is ultimately the more important of the two abolitionist goals, that I support abolishing the police, I support defunding the police, but I believe getting rid of the prisons is ultimately the higher priority because it's more clearly a continuation of the institution of slavery that has really been one of the most hideous stains on this country's conscience for many years.
And of course, you know, we live here in upstate New York, which New York State, along with California, just in this country, but really the whole entire world, has one of the highest concentrations of prisons. So there's probably no better place to be an abolitionist than where it's needed most, right here in upstate New York.
That was Brendan Dunn interviewing Alyssa Bolt of the Utica Abolitionists and the Rome Three.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kalen.
And I'm Erica. You are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network for the Sanctuary of Independent Media. Check us out online at themediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Barbie Escuerdo, Community Empowerment Manager with Hungry Free America, talks about food insecurity and shares her story. If you have experienced food insecurity and would like to share a story, please contact Barbie at bizsquerdo@hungryfreeamerica.org. For additional information, go to Hungry Free America's website. Hosted by Michelle Mazarion with Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Good day, all. This is Michelle Mazarion for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and my guest today is Barbie Escuerdo. Hopefully I didn't massacre your name. Community Empowerment Manager at Hunger Free America. Welcome, Barbie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So can you tell our listeners, what is the organization Hunger Free America? What's his mission?
Sure. So Hunger Free America is a national nonprofit organization that engages in both advocacy and direct services. We serve low-income people by lifting up the policy solutions we develop in collaboration with our communities and bringing them into the room where decisions are made. We believe that the emergency food systems fills a gap, but the answer to long-term hunger is an expansion and increased participation of the federal safety net. Nutrition programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is also known as SNAP, and was formerly known as food stamps, are designed to address hunger and to expand with the size of the need so that every eligible person who applies will get it. Not only do these benefits provide 10 meals for every one that a food pantry can serve, it also has reimbursement mechanisms that can generate funds for the city and state government as well, as it preserves jobs at grocery stores and supermarkets. There's a lot of benefits to programs like this, but there's also a lot of stigma and a lot of barriers to people applying. My role is to engage people of low-income communities and the community itself throughout the country and to help them learn about the services that are available to them. My goal is to help make their voices heard and push government to do more to help them, not less. And anyone can do this work if they know how, and we just hope that our work won't be necessary someday because we'll have solved hunger.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. So what communities and what areas are you serving in your role?
So I serve on a national scale. So okay. I am currently working on our food action board. And what that basically is what I'm doing for the food action board is I'm looking for people with lived experience, just as myself, who are willing to testify at Congress, get into these rooms with senators, legislators, and explain why these programs aren't working, if they are, what is, what needs to be fixed, how it's affecting the community. So because I personally have been a part of an organized group like that, I'm now blessed enough to say that I'm on the other side and helping to find people to do the same things that I've been doing.
What does it mean for someone to be food insecure? You know, can you share some stories? And if you want to share your story?
Absolutely. Being food insecure, in all honesty, where I would have to start personally is how it's affected me. I have dealt with a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment, because I was featured in a documentary called A Place at the Table, which talks about hunger in America. In that documentary, you can see me struggling to feed my kids. You can see that, like, they have a shot of my kids eating Chef Boyardee and I'm in another room eating a sandwich, no mayonnaise, no, just, you know, bread, cheese, and salami. And I was separated from them because I didn't want them to see that I wasn't having the same meal that they had. And in the beginning of the documentary, I talk about how, like, I would never feed my kids Chef Boyardee because I had to eat that every day growing up. And then, of course, throughout the documentary, they show you that eventually I do have to resort to that. What it does to you psychologically are things that can affect you for the rest of your life. And I still struggle to talk about these things without getting emotional. So I apologize if it happens. I've been through situations where I've had to yell at my kids and force them to go to sleep because they said they were hungry and I just didn't have anything to give them. I've been in situations where I've had to go to food banks, food pantries, soup kitchens, and at times they were at capacity. I've been on the other side volunteering and working for food organizations and having to tell people we don't have any more. I worked for the Coalition Against Hunger for a few years here in Philadelphia. I went from, you know, knowing what it's like to go through these programs and how hard the application processes are and how they're delayed and how social workers are overworked. And then, you know, here I am having the ability to fill out these applications for people over the phone, getting their paperwork for them, submitting them all together in their application. But in the same sense, having to tell them, well, you qualify for $16. And it hurts to know, like, it was a double-edged sword because it's like, you know, I know that these programs aren't perfect, but we're helping someone, right, in some way. So you have to feel good and be happy. But again, telling a senior who has to pay for their own medication and has co-pays for their doctor visits that you're eligible for $16 a month in food stamps really doesn't help them. So it was hard. I still struggle at times with feeling like I might be an unfit mother because I've exposed my struggles to the public. You know, this stuff is Googleable. It's going to be out for the rest of their lives. Like, I've wondered how it's going to affect my children. I've also struggled with feeling less than, and like I have to prove myself harder than other people. Burnout happens a lot more. The shame takes over at times of having to admit that this is what I've been through. This is my life. And to still focus on trying to make people see that there are millions of people out there like me who are struggling. But it's a little harder when you use yourself in order to make changes.
Right.
So what I hope to do in the 13 years that I've been doing this is to make that process a little easier because I didn't have any guidance when I started telling my story. So if I can help find people and help them throughout the process with finding mental health resources, finding out if there's any other programs that might help them that affect their social determinants of health. You know, it might not just be food insecurity. There's poverty, there's housing issues, there's domestic violence, there's violence, there's drugs, there's a lot of things that go on in these neighborhoods that sometimes when you're from these neighborhoods, you just feel like they don't care.
Yeah.
It's not gonna matter.
I appreciate you sharing your story and, you know, its impact on you and just the struggle for individuals to go through an application process is a barrier. And here all people want is food. How important then would you say are food pantries?
I think that food pantries are very necessary. The problem is that sometimes when people look at food solutions, they look at, okay, it's either this or that. And what we need to realize is that it's a combination of things. If we're really going to solve this issue and not just, you know, resolve a problem, if we want a true solution, then it takes a lot of things working together. You know, the SNAP program is a supplement. It's supposed to help you and not give you everything that you need. So there are a lot of working families who are on SNAP, but still don't have enough. From my personal experience, when I would go through that, that's where I would go. I would go to the food pantries. At the time in my neighborhood, there were certain limitations, like you can only go once every 30 days and things like that. But when you're in those situations, there's not just one solution. There might be, yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to have to kind of move this along because we're getting near the end of our time. Sure. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners that we haven't touched upon? And is there any suggestions that you would like to, if you were talking to a politician, what would you say?
I think that politicians should definitely bring more people with lived experience to the room. I think that when considering what programs should have their funding cut or their budgets edited, that they should definitely have in consideration the people that they're affecting. If there's anything that I would, any message that I would want people to hear is that, you know, you're not alone in experiencing this. And if there's any way that, you know, I myself or Hunger Free America can help connect people to resources, then we most definitely will do so.
Well, I hate to end the program. And I thank you so much for being with me today, Barbie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
On Friday, November 13th, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Zoom Underground Railroad Educational Center book reads Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880 by W.E.B. Du Bois. In this part one of five segments, you will hear the study group discuss Chapter 9, The Peace of Disaster, of the 746-page book. UERC founder Paul and Ms. Larry Stewart moderate the discussion. This is part four, not part one.
It's all. I saw something last week about how Denmark, some on PBS, how Denmark had, I think it was Denmark, had turned around the damage that they did to the fishing industry because they put regulations on it, God forbid, and now their populations of sea critters have come back, so now they've got an industry again. But there's all swaths, areas of the eastern seaboard of U.S., I guess, and Canada that have never come back because they didn't get around to trying to regulate it in time, so they just destroyed the whole. And you know, you could probably say the same thing about how we're treating COVID too. God forbid we should try to be intelligent. But the thing that I really liked, he kept saying patience, Du Bois, I mean, how the capital in the North didn't have patience to wait for things to start working themselves out. And I know that's true, but I also, going back to that paragraph you come up with, Paul, with the one and the two economic systems where you got, it's either the proletariat or the, you know, the little oligarchy of rich guys. You know, it's like, well, those two. I mean, it's one thing that I've always noticed in Du Bois, even before getting to here, is that he's kind of Platonic, and so he's a person of his place in history. And when I looked at, so at the bottom of 347, there's this paragraph there that I see I got in the margins, something on this line where it says, talks about one cannot study Reconstruction without first frankly facing the facts of universal lying. The deliberate and unbounded attempts to prove a case and win a dispute, preserve economic mastery and political domination by besmirching the character, morals, and common sense of every single person who dared disagree with the dominant philosophy of the White South.
That's what I was referring to earlier about lying, you know, and everything that came up that didn't go with that philosophy. The people were either lying, they were scallywags, they were, you know, somehow corrupt, you know, whatever, you know. Yeah. And I think that was the same thing that was reflected in the reaction of the congressional conservative Republicans to President Obama, that, you know, everything he did had to be wrong, you know.
I watched a PBS last night too, just waiting because the news hour didn't come up in time. So I'm watching this thing about the study of the first 4 years of the Weimar Republic, that first 4 years of the 30s of Germany before the rise of Hitler. There's this guy named Schleicher who was in there, and he's this just aristocratic scholar guy who's just sitting around trying to figure out how to run the world. And he's able to pull strings because he's able to talk to all the bosses, and they decide they're going to use Hitler because he's popular. He's got his feet on the ground, and he can, so they manipulate this guy. And, you know, lo and behold, Hitler ends up reversing everything because he ends up with the power. Why did I end up there? Well, but he's very, this aristocratic perspective. Anyway, when I'm thinking, when you say philosophy, I mean, I'm thinking about philosophy because I've got way too much time studying philosophy, but the dominant philosophy for me is this aristocratic perspective. Mm-hmm. So when you say the white working class, why do they see themselves more in line with the oligarchy and the capitalists? It's like this whole built-in worldview of what's rational and what can be reasonable. And I mean, there's reasons you don't want to support the Black Lives Matter, for example, or it's like you got the pressures. It's like if I burn the powers that be, I'm in trouble. I mean, I can't stand up because to certain things. I mean, you just have that fear. Like, why do you not want to throw yourself in with the black workers? Look what they put up with, God. And then I've got if I do that, maybe I'm going right against the oligarchy and all these crooks. So how about if I just try to skip through the middle and maintain some sense of morality, and, you know, and not hurt blacks, but, you know, and then obviously you're playing the system and you're complicit and you fail anyway. But, I was just thinking it's a little deeper in my, so the patience that he's talking about. There's other points where he talks about the whites don't really have any leadership, the poor whites in particular. They don't really have any way of, any paradigmatic, philosophical way of getting out of this problem. And I've talked to you guys about this before. Going back to this period, the mid-19th century would just be awesome in a way, because you've got Darwin, you've got Marx, you've got Peirce and the pragmatists, you know, and all this just, first time we ever like started being able to think about, you know, the structures of reality and how it relates to policy and how we treat each other. And I don't think we've resolved many of the questions, but the questions have, that's when they kind of came out. I'm just thinking that to answer to nine isn't, I don't really have an answer to it, but it's a great question. And it opens up a lot of these things where I'm dwelling all the time.
Well, I think that, you know, I just think that Du Bois, one of the things, the beauty of the book is that it opens our eyes to a lot of other things that were happening during the period. The very fact that he analyzes what was happening for black workers in terms of a class of labor, and he then gives that class of labor and the choice of that class of labor, you know, some power within the bigger story. And it kind of helps you realize that in some ways that if the teller of a story or the teller of history, the describer of history, you know, what the describer takes as key points and how they elaborate it, is incredible in terms of interpreting that history to us, you know, in this day and age, or in any day and age. And it makes you realize that there's so much that you're missing, you know. And for instance, in this, he talks about the poor whites having, I want to say having no spokesperson, as it were, because primarily they're looking, kind of aping after the aristocratic planter class. You know, they're looking at them and saying, oh, you know, like they want to be like them. And the same for the industrial, for the capital angle. You know, people are saying, oh, I want to be rich, you know, and hoping I can be rich. And so being rich is moving into the capitalist class. So, but what I was trying to get at there is that without a lot more detail of the history, it's hard to know who the players actually were. You know, the story that he brings out here, when he talks about the labor conventions, the black labor conventions, and even, you know, like when we read the story about how the Irish became white, you know, looking at how the labor unions were formed and how they reacted to different things, you know, and it just seems to me that there's so much in the story that makes it hard for us to get our hands around.
That was Willie Terry, Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network Roman Labor Correspondent, attended the Zoom Underground Railroad Educational Center book, reads Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 through 1880 by W.E.B. Du Bois. You will hear the study group discuss chapter 9. The price disaster of the 746-page book, UREC founders Paul and Mary Liz Stewart moderate the discussion.
Lukey Forbes is a community activist who fought for the rights of Black and Brown people within the Capital Region. Tune in to hear HMM correspondent Erica Dulcany digs as she spoke with Forbes about the community call-out event that was held on November 30th at Albany City Hall at 8:30 a.m. located on Eagle Street. The interview was recorded before the event.
This is HMM correspondent Erica Diggs for the Media Sanctuary. And last time we spoke with the activist Luke Forbes, he told us about labeling racism as a public health crisis, the issues that Black people face in Albany, and more. Today we are covering code enforcement, good cause eviction, and code violators. Please welcome Lukey Forbes. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. And yourself?
I'm good. It's a pleasure to have you back as always.
Yeah, I love it. I love being here. You guys definitely share out all the good information.
Oh man, we can't wait to get you to the actual station one day. You're part of the family, so it'll be great. All right. So why is it so hard for Black and Brown communities to receive basic rights from the government and their cities?
That is a good question. And the answer is the same answer that I've been giving. It's because of the systematic racism that's embedded within our policies and the actual laws that are in place. As long as these different policies and laws are in place, it will be no change as far as what the Black community receives. The laws were created by racists to basically empower racism within our communities. So the reason why we aren't seeing any actual change in that is because most politicians are afraid to go against the norm and step away from the old racist teachings and practices because they're afraid to lose and affect their voters. So if their voters are supporting these different racist bills and racist laws, they're not going to say, hey, we need to cut this out of our laws, or maybe we should add a law that would actually protect these individuals if what their voters are asking for. So we need more politicians that are more morally based and are against enforcing or even implementing any discriminational practices. So what I suggest is that we actually have each of our politicians swear within their oath upon taking office that they swear to be impartial and not be discriminatory or practice in any discriminatory practices or implement any discriminatory laws, and that they will literally swear to breaking down systematic racism. So unless we actually get our politicians to swear to those things, they're not going to really change that because it doesn't really affect their vote. This is 400 years later. So it's not as if we're speaking on something that is like 20 years out of segregation. We're speaking on stuff that's been 56 years out of segregation. So it's been at least a half a century where people were able to implement laws or change anything if they wanted to. The reason why it's not changing is because currently our politicians don't really care for it to change or want it to change. And as well, it's also job security, where they have our communities so provaged and filled with so many different illegal activities and not enough opportunities so that they can continue to employ cops, they can continue to employ correctional officers and keep that job security in there. As well as it helps with capitalism, as I explained, the whole prison industry still being a slave camp last time I spoke. So as long as all those things are in place, our laws will be the way that they are in order to keep us down.
But also, how do you feel if we did implement them taking an oath to not discriminate against us? How would you feel about if they broke that oath? Do you think they should receive some kind of jail time or some kind of repercussion?
Currently breaking an oath of office is a misdemeanor. So right. I feel as if we definitely need it to be a hefty fine. And for a politician, because they have control and affects their decisions affect the people. So yes, I feel that they should definitely do jail time if they break that oath of office, because you're affecting a whole community and they have this immunity so that they can affect whole communities in negative ways and not receive any form of repercussions. So I feel like that does need to change.
Okay. What if my landlord does not have a ROP, which is a residential occupancy permit, to lease? What do I do?
So currently that is needed, but it's not something that's enforced. Code enforcement doesn't request that upon any complaints, nor do judges request that upon any landlord filing to evict a tenant. So a landlord can literally just be having people live in their apartment and then decide that they want to evict them and not even have a ROP, a residential occupancy permit, and still go about evicting that person, still go about collecting rent, even though they don't have the proper paperwork to do so.
All right. What are some factors to look out for when renting?
Factors to look out for renting is to make sure that your landlord actually is following proper protocol. Right now, they can't charge you anything other than first month's rent and security deposit. They can't charge you for back month's rent or anything like that. A lot of them try to add on different types of fees, a redecoration fee, all types of things like that, just to get around that loophole. But you want to make sure that your landlord is definitely up to par as far as following regulations like that. And then when you enter the apartment, you want to definitely take pictures and notate any forms of damages or anything like that so that your landlord doesn't later on try to blame those things on you as well. It also is a red flag, like if you see big damages in your apartment when you're trying to rent it itself, that may mean that your landlord will not go about fixing or repairing things later on when you do complain about broken items.
What does the good cause eviction bill cover?
Good cause eviction is exactly what it sounds like. You can only be evicted for a good cause, like a person that just is refusing to pay rent, a person that is damaging things in the property. Okay, those are good reasons to want to evict someone. But when landlords are just literally evicting people just so that they can turn the property, let's say they want to turn it into a luxury apartment building or something like that, where they're just thinking of unnecessary reasons to evict these people, we want to definitely stop stuff like that from happening. So that's really what good cause eviction is. It only allows evictions to happen when there is a valid reason.
Okay. What if I'm wrongfully evicted? What do I do?
If you're wrongfully evicted right now, there's really not any real protections out there for you to prove that you were wrongfully evicted. Right now, the way that laws are set up, landlords can just evict you for really any reason.
That really is not fair, because people have lost their jobs due to this pandemic and are literally like pinching pennies to even try to pay their rent.
And even right now, as we speak in this pandemic, keep going with your questions, because I believe you asked a question that's similar.
Okay, so what are the effects of eviction?
The effects of eviction, it increases homelessness, it increases crime in our areas, it increases the spreading of diseases. The evictions play a big toll in urban communities and causing urban communities to be the way that they are.
What would the bill do for low-income Black and brown renters?
It would literally protect all those individuals from being evicted for no reason at all and from being like really scrutinized against. I feel like Black and brown renters really need the good cause eviction, because we really only see unnecessary evictions within the Black and brown community. And that, again, it streams that racism is a public health crisis, where evictions cause towards public health crises. And we normally see this going on within urban communities.
Okay. And let's say I am being evicted during COVID-19 and I have been paying my rent. Is there a possibility of suing my landlord?
Yes and no. It really is touch and go and depends on the situation. But right now, it's so hard for tenants to really prove that they are being wrongfully convicted. Right now, judges will literally say if you are not affected by COVID to the point where you're not even receiving unemployment checks, that you could have paid your rent and things like that. So, and even the unemployment checks, they even state that they're not supposed to be used to pay rent, but judges are saying that, yes, since you received unemployment checks, you should have paid rent with that. Even though there are other factors that COVID does affect, kids are out of school. So if a single mother has kids, doesn't have access to childcare, she may have to call out of work a few times to take care of her kid. And then that may make her end up getting fired. And if she gets fired for that reason, she won't receive unemployment. So there are other factors that play into the effects of COVID. Even kids who stay home, they have to eat now and they're not eating that school lunch. So now that is also another price. And if you do have to hire a babysitter so that you can go to work, again, that's more money coming out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. So we're really just seeing how judges aren't taking any of those things into consideration, nor does Governor Cuomo's momentum take those things into consideration. So COVID really does have a big effect, and there's really not too much that tenants can really do to fight against evictions right now.
Okay. What are some of the guidelines landlords must follow to evict a tenant during the pandemic?
So it's still the same guidelines. They just have to notify them 5 days prior and then 14 days after that, that they'll be being evicted for either lack of payment, damage to property, or something like that. So it's literally just the same protocol. And sheriffs have said that they see the same amount of evictions happening now that they've seen before. Mm-hmm. So even prior to COVID, they're seeing the same amount of evictions going on within the city of Auburn.
Okay, folks, don't forget, for those of you just tuning in, there is an event called Community Callouts. It will be held on November 30th at 8:30 a.m. at Albany City Hall, located at 24 Eagle Street. You don't want to miss it. They will be covering good cause, eviction, code enforcement, and code violators. You can even tune in online at United Tenants of Albany's Facebook page, and the link will also be shared on Lukey Ford's Facebook page, as well as our page, Media Sanctuary. Thank you so much, Mr. Forbes.
Appreciate you guys.
You just heard from Lukey Forbes, the community activist who fights for the rights of Black and brown people within the Capital Region.
Well, that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Erica. Our engineer tonight is the lovely Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. right after we get off here. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.